Welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. Today, we're going to be looking at some really, really interesting issues in New York law. Specifically, we're going to discuss the New York standard for the insanity defense, the legality of certain interrogation tactics, DNA evidence, and what really happens when a case ends in a mistrial. All of this will be discussed in the context of the truly tragic killing of Howard Beach jogger Karina Vetrano and the resulting prosecution. This is The State of New York versus Chanel Lewis. Let's start off with a discussion of who Karina Vetrano was. She was the daughter of Philip and Catherine Vetrano, born July 12, 1986. Her father was a retired firefighter. He was a first responder during 9/11. She had a brother and a sister. She was very close with her parents. After graduating from Archbishop Molloy High School and St. John's University, both located in Queens, New York, she moved back to the Spring Creek Park neighborhood in Queens, where her parents lived. She obtained a master's degree in speech pathology. She worked with children with autism while supplementing that income with a catering job. According to Jackie Hartenstein, a close friend of Vetrano's, her two passions were writing and jogging. In 2013, she appeared in a short film based on some of her writings, and she was an avid daily runner, usually with her father. Her passion for jogging developed from a young age when she had to have surgery on her legs and doctors told her parents that she may never run again. Up until August 2, 2016, the story of Karina Vetrano had been an underdog story of a girl who defied the odds and succeeded despite extreme hardship. Vetrano also had pretty significant online presence. She had thousands of followers on Instagram, she had a blog of her intimate thoughts and feelings, and her social media pages are private now, but previously they had been full of selfies and posts about her travels. Chanel Lewis was a first-generation American, the son of Richard, a retired elementary school teacher and administrator, and Vita Lewis, who came to America from Jamaica in 1992. He was born in 1996, which made him 20 years old at the time of Karina Vetrano's death. Lewis lived in East New York, the section of New York City with the highest violent crime rate. East New York is the easternmost neighborhood in Brooklyn, and it borders the Howard Beach section of Queens. It's very close to Spring Creek Park, which is a subset of Howard Beach. Lewis lived with his mother in a housing project. He has a documented history of paranoid schizophrenia, which we'll discuss a little bit later on. Chanel Lewis was a young man seemingly at odds with himself. He was described as quiet and humble. He received multiple academic awards and was twice named to the honor roll while he was in school. He had no criminal record. But at the same time, Lewis had been taken into custody on more than one occasion as an emotionally disturbed person. Now, this is not an arrest, but rather a brief temporary confinement in order to establish safety and make sure that nobody gets hurt. Additionally, a teacher's aide at Lewis's school claims that Lewis had said that he wanted to knife his female classmates. He seemed to have anger-related issues toward women. Lewis also had other run-ins with the police, though nothing serious. He had a few summonses for violating Spring Creek Park rules. He was ticketed once for public urination, but he'd never actually been charged with any real criminal conduct. There's also no indication that Lewis and Vetrano had ever met or interacted at all. Let's briefly discuss what we know about Karina Vetrano's death. On August 2, 2016, Vetrano was planning to go on a run with her father, but Philip Vetrano was having back pain, and he canceled on her. He cautioned her about running through Spring Creek Park because it had become a nexus for migrants, and Philip was concerned about Karina's safety. The last words she ever spoke to her father were a reassurance that she would be fine. She started her jog around 5 p.m. When she didn't return after a reasonable period of time, her father became anxious. He went to a neighbor who was a high-ranking NYPD officer, and a search team was formed. Vetrano's body was located just after 11 p.m., around 15 feet off the running path in Spring Creek Park. It was a truly gruesome scene. Her clothing had been removed. She had bruises and scratches all over her body. There's evidence that she had been sexually assaulted. And Philip Vetrano himself found the body. The actual cause of death was determined to be strangulation by the medical examiner. The NYPD statement on the scene claimed that Vetrano had fought for her life. She had tufts of grass in her hand when she was found, indicating that she had been fighting back against being dragged off the path. She had her attacker's DNA under her fingernails, on her back, and on her discarded cell phone. It also appeared that she had bit her attacker so hard that she had cracked her teeth. Law enforcement ran the DNA, but no matches were returned. Those of you who lived in New York City and the surrounding area in mid to late 2016 are very likely to remember the massive press coverage this case generated. New York City is no stranger to violent crime, but since the 1990s, the murder rates have fallen sharply. By 2016, a murder which wasn't somehow connected to gangs or drugs, but which involved an attractive 30-year-old woman, was a pretty rare event. And as a result, there was a lot of pressure on the NYPD to find the killer fast. For months, the NYPD chased down dead-end leads. They became frustrated that they had the killer's DNA, but nothing in their system or the federal DNA database matched the profile. The NYPD offered $10,000 for information leading to an arrest and conviction. It was eventually raised to $35,000. The Vetrano family themselves started a GoFundMe page, offering $250,000 to anyone who could identify the killer. The page actually raised nearly $290,000, and the Vetrano family planned to donate anything over $250,000 to charity. They even offered that the money could go to the killer himself to give to his family if he would simply turn himself in. Despite this huge monetary offering, it seemed that nobody had any viable information. So how did the NYPD land on Chanel Lewis? Around 6 months into the investigation, a police officer named John Russo remembered that he had noticed Lewis in Howard Beach, in the vicinity of Spring Creek Park, acting strangely back in May 2016, a few months prior to the murder. Russo lived in the area and had observed Lewis near his home, meandering down the street, looking into car windows. Russo called the local Howard Beach precinct, who came and stopped Chanel Lewis. He was identified, but there was no reason to hold him at the time, as he hadn't actually committed any real crime. The officers filled out their stop and frisk paperwork, and Lewis was let go. Russo then asked the officers to dig up that old stop and frisk paperwork, and they identified Lewis. Then they found the multiple summonses that he had received from that neighborhood as well. The NYPD concluded that Lewis spent a fair amount of time in Spring Creek Park, specifically in the area where Vetrano's body was found, especially around the time that the murder took place. Despite having unsuccessfully compared DNA samples from the crime scene to over 600 potential donors, the police dutifully visited Lewis's home and asked him to provide a sample and give his whereabouts on August 2, 2016. Lewis willingly provided his DNA on February 2, 2017, which was determined to be a match for the source material left at the crime scene. According to Lewis's mother, he had gone out on August 2, 2016 and had come home disheveled. His clothing was torn. Lewis claimed that he had been mugged by a group of men, but no police report was ever filed. The following day, however, his father took him to the local emergency room for the cuts and scratches all over his body. On February 4, 2017, Chanel Lewis was arrested and taken into custody. The following day, at 10:31 a.m., Detective Joseph Deal turned on a video camera in the 107th Precinct interrogation room, and together with Queens County Assistant District Attorney Peter McCormick III, conducted an interrogation of Chanel Lewis. McCormick read Lewis his Miranda rights on the tape and asked if Lewis would answer questions. Lewis simply said, "Okay," and nodded slightly. Over the course of several hours of the videotaped interrogation, Lewis confessed to being in the park, seeing Vetrano jogging towards him, hitting her several times over the head, dragging her off the path, and killing her. He provided details about the scene that had not been released to the press, and the NYPD was supremely confident that they had found the killer. Lewis said that he had been upset that neighbors had been playing music too loud, so he left his house angry, and when he came across Vetrano, he says he just saw red. With this confession on tape and a DNA match, the NYPD thought this case was a slam dunk due to their thorough and tireless investigation. As I've discussed previously on this podcast, serious felony trials, especially murder trials, take a long time to prepare for. In this case, Lewis was arrested February 4th, 2017, but the trial didn't commence until November 4th, 2018. Now, some really interesting things happened in this intervening time period. We know, as I mentioned previously, that Chanel Lewis had a documented history of paranoid schizophrenia, that he'd been taken into custody, though not arrested, as an emotionally disturbed person. His legal aid attorney, Robert Mueller, not to be confused with the Department of Justice special counsel, Robert Mueller, immediately contemplated the insanity defense. Lewis had documented mental health issues, and Mueller wanted to explore whether these could constitute a defense to the charges. So let's take a moment to discuss exactly how the insanity defense works in New York, and what the defense is required to show in order to successfully argue it. The first thing a defense attorney is required to do is provide notice to the court and to the prosecutor that the defendant intends to put forth a mental illness argument at the trial. The notice does not require the defense to make the arguments at trial, but the law states that the prosecutor and the judge must be made aware of the defense's intention to make such an argument early on in the process. The reason for this is that the legislator doesn't want defense attorneys to spring an insanity defense on the prosecution on the eve of trial and deprive the prosecutor of conducting their own investigation into the mental health and fitness of a defendant simply because of time constraints. In the interest of fairness to both parties, each side is afforded sufficient time to prepare arguments for or against a defendant having a mental illness. Once the notice is filed, typically the defendant is interviewed by a forensic mental health expert from each side. This is almost always a forensic psychiatrist or psychologist. The term forensic correlates to the intersection of law and the field of study. So a forensic accountant is somebody who analyzes books and ledgers for the purpose of aiding upcoming litigation. A forensic anthropologist studies human remains to aid in solving crimes. And a forensic psychiatrist or psychologist examines a person's mental health to determine whether they're either competent to stand trial or fit the legal definition for insanity. Keep in mind that a person's competency to stand trial is different than whether or not they were legally insane at the time of the commission of a crime. We'll discuss the competency issue in a later episode, as we don't really have time to go through that here, but it's a very interesting concept as well. So, a defense forensic expert will claim that the defendant was insane at the time of the commission of the crime, and the prosecutor's expert will claim that the defendant was sane at the time of the commission of the crime, otherwise the case will be resolved. But what does the term insane actually mean in the context of a criminal proceeding in New York? The statute which establishes the affirmative defense of insanity in New York reads as follows. In any prosecution for an offense, it is an affirmative defense that when the defendant engaged in the prescribed conduct, he lacked criminal responsibility by reason of mental disease or defect. Such lack of criminal responsibility means that at the time of such conduct, as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacked substantial capacity to appreciate one, the nature and consequences of such conduct, or two, that such conduct was wrong. That narrow definition is the only recognized argument for a mental disease defense in New York. You'll notice it does not indicate that a person who is incapable of stopping him or herself, or what is known as a volitional defense, is covered. People who hear voices commanding them to do things and feel compelled to act, knowing such actions are wrong, but feel that they have to because of an external malevolent force, are considered sane by the state of New York and can be criminally prosecuted without issue. A claim that a person is not responsible by reason of mental disease is an affirmative defense. This means that the burden of establishing the truth of this actually rests with the defendant himself or herself. The defendant is required to show, and a judge or jury must find by a preponderance of the evidence, meaning by 51% or roughly, that it's more likely than not that this person suffers from this malady in order to credit and accept the defense. Arguing the insanity defense is incredibly hard to do in New York. To show that a person was unable to appreciate that something was wrong or the nature of what they were doing requires essentially arguing to a judge or jury that the person was in the midst of a real break with reality at the specific moment the crime took place. Often the only real evidence of that is a claim made by the defendant himself, which juries are often understandably reluctant to credit without any corroboration. Even people with documented histories of mental illness have difficulty showing that this one particular act occurred without their ability to really comprehend that it was wrong. Believe me, the insanity defense is a long shot, which is truly troubling because of the noted increase in criminal prosecutions of people who have clear mental illness. Two final things to note about the insanity defense. First, as one can imagine, sometimes people who are truly mentally ill refuse to participate in a forensic evaluation with either their own expert or the prosecution's expert. When this happens, a judge will preclude the defense attorney from calling their expert or introducing any report generated by that expert, which suggests that the defendant is not responsible by means of a mental disease or defect. However, the defense attorney is still free to argue to the jury that the facts and circumstances of the incident show that the defendant was unable to appreciate the nature and consequences. But as you can imagine, without having a doctor take the stand and say as much, it becomes even more difficult to argue. Second, if a jury determines that a person is not criminally responsible due to mental disease, they're not simply released back in society. They're evaluated by additional forensic experts who are non-biased to determine whether the mental disease is dangerous. And if it is, they're typically confined in a secure psychiatric institution for an extended period of time before the state is comfortable enough to release them. With that in mind, back to Chanel Lewis. Knowing his documented history of mental illness, Robert Mueller filed the notice of intent to argue the insanity defense at his trial. Mueller arranged for his forensic examiner to conduct an evaluation of Lewis. But when the parties returned to court in October of 2017, Mueller indicated that he was withdrawing the notice. Mueller reaffirmed that Lewis, in fact, did suffer from a serious mental illness, but that his forensic expert had indicated to him that it simply did not rise to the level required by the statute. So he informed the court that he had no plans to argue that Lewis should be found not responsible because of a mental disease or defect. Now, the case went to trial on November 5th, 2018. The prosecutor was an assistant district attorney named Brad Leventhal, and the judge was the Honorable Gregory Lasek. In the late summer of 2018, I tried a homicide case against Brad Leventhal in Queens, in front of Judge Lasek. Leventhal's a very good attorney. He is animated and passionate in front of a jury. He's also concise, sticks to his narrative. Judge Lasek is an ex-homicide prosecutor in Queens. He is wonderfully pleasant and personable in chambers, but very stoic during trials. He's fair-minded, but perhaps leans a little more towards the prosecution side in his rulings. Let's talk about the prosecution's case. We've covered it piecemeal, but essentially here is what Leventhal argued in a nutshell. Vetrano was sexually assaulted and brutally murdered. Solid police work had led to Lewis as a suspect. DNA swab had been voluntarily offered, had been matched to the DNA from the crime scene. Lewis had been interviewed on tape and had confessed to the crime. Now, let's talk about what Mueller argued because it's far more interesting for our purposes. When Mueller dropped the insanity defense, he was put in a position where he didn't need to prove anything at the trial. The burden of proof rests solely with the prosecution in terms of guilt at a criminal trial. If an affirmative defense is argued, such as insanity or self-defense, Then the defense attorney has to convince the jury of something, and the prosecutor has to rebut them. But in general, prosecutors have to prove their cases. So Lewis didn't need to prove anything. What his attorney did was to sow doubt. To convict, a jury must be convinced that guilt has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I discussed reasonable doubt in some detail in the episode on Casey Anthony, so I'm not going to go into it again here, but it's a high, high standard. Mueller wanted to create doubt about the confession and the DNA results. So let's talk about the interrogation first. Mueller argued that this was a false confession. It came out during trial testimony that Lewis had been interviewed for roughly 4 hours before law enforcement had started the tape. He argued that the police had taken advantage of a 20-year-old mentally ill boy, had essentially put words in his mouth, and then coerced him into regurgitating them on camera. The police are afforded a good deal of leeway in conducting suspect interrogations. They're permitted to lie, to leave inferences that they know are not true in order to try and provoke answers. Under the law in New York, it is acceptable for law enforcement to use what is termed, quote, non-coercive subterfuge, end quote, when questioning a person. What this means is that the police cannot beat a confession out of a person, but they are not precluded from telling that person that another person put them at the crime scene, or they have lab results which indicate guilt, or that if they get out in front of this thing, the police will tell the DA how helpful the defendant was. There are training sessions, seminars, conferences for police officers on how to conduct effective interrogations. And don't get me wrong, that's their job. I would expect that society feels slightly safer, knowing that law enforcement is permitted to nudge people a bit towards confession. But as Mueller argued, this also can lead to false confessions. Mueller claimed that false confessions usually take place in high-profile and serious cases. They usually involve younger men. They occur after hours of relentless police questioning and are more common among people who have either lower intelligence or some degree of mental illness. Mueller is right about all of these assertions, but the way that he worded his argument was very precise, because false confessions are actually pretty rare. Had Mueller claimed that false confessions happen all the time, it would have been easily rebutted by Leventhal. But when Mueller discussed them, he always discussed the demographics in the context of a world of false confessions, rather than of confessions in general. It's true that most false confessions involve young men in high-profile cases who have lower developmental intelligence. But here's a metaphor to really illustrate this point. Let's say you have 100 apples. 97 apples are red, 3 are green. Of those 3 green apples, 2 of them have blue spots. You can accurately state that most green apples have blue spots, but that doesn't mean that most apples have blue spots. But if you pick and choose your wording right, you can leave that impression without having to explicitly say it. Next, Mueller had to grapple with the DNA results, which matched Lewis to the source material left at the crime scene. Here's a basic crash course in how DNA testing works for the purposes of criminal trials. When source material is collected from a crime scene, which could be hair, skin, blood, saliva, bodily fluids, etc., a scientist in a crime lab generates a DNA profile of that source material. Now, we're not going to go into the specifics on how DNA is extracted from cells or the finer points of the scientific work here, but the test results come in a chart called an electropherogram, which maps out the specific genetic profile for the DNA source. It's a series of unique genetic markers different in every person. It's like a snowflake. With that profile, the lab technician can search local and national databases to see if there's a match anywhere in the system. If there isn't, then the lab will compare unique samples that law enforcement collects during the course of the investigation to try and come up with a match. To compare samples, lab technicians take the source, lay the suspect's sample chart over the source chart to see if the markers line up. If they do, it's a match. If not, they move on to the next subject. But an issue arises when the source material only provides enough DNA for a partial profile. What happens when you only have 50% of the chart filled in? And that 50% matches somebody, but you can't be sure if the other 50% will. Well, the answer is you can't know for certain. So when DNA is discussed in court, Expert witnesses will typically use terms like consistent and inconsistent, and will discuss matching in terms of the probability that the suspect isn't the person who generated the source material. In Lewis's case, expert witness Linda Rizzano testified that based on Lewis's genetic markers, there was a 1 in 6 trillion chance that he was not the source of the material found at the Vetrano crime scene. That's about as close to metaphysical certainty as I think it sounds like we can get. But there are issues with DNA testing, as Mueller pointed out. Samples can become contaminated by careless handlers, which could disrupt getting an accurate profile. Also, as scientific as the testing itself is, unless there's a match in the computer system, the comparisons are still largely done by humans, which are prone, of course, to human error. At the trial, however, Mueller put forth a non-serious argument that the DNA sample from the scene was contaminated, and therefore the match couldn't be relied upon. This is basically nonsense. But he put forth an additional argument, one which actually resonated a bit with the jury. He claimed racism. Mueller argued that of the approximately 600 profiles that were tested, over 360 of them were from African Americans, and that the police were only focusing in on black subjects to test. He claimed that Lewis was only tested because the NYPD was singling out every black person who could be found and identified as having been in that area. Let's be clear, this is an argument based solely on emotion and not really based on science. The DNA results matched to the point where there was testimony that there was merely a 1 in 6 trillion chance that it was not Lewis's DNA under Vetrano's fingernails, on her body, and on her cell phone. But court cases are not always won on facts. Making the right impressions on the jury is often far more significant. Mueller understood this. And every jury in Queens is exceedingly ethnically diverse. So he wanted to inflame the passions of the jurors against law enforcement a little bit. This is an effective tactic with a jury if done correctly. For his part, Brad Leventhal played the cards he had. And if he were taking an honest appraisal of those cards, Leventhal had all the aces. A trial is what lawyers refer to as a closed universe. The only things that are true are what is able to be established by evidence. If you want to make an argument during a trial in your summation, you either need testimony or some tangible evidence to back up what you're saying, or the opposing counsel will win on an objection that you're alluding to facts, not in evidence. Judges instruct juries over and over again that they are only to accept as true the evidence which is presented in court, and they're to set aside anything else they may have heard, either in the media, from their outside personal knowledge, from their own history, anything that they knew previously about the situation. Jurors are explicitly told not to speculate, try and fill in the gaps of the things that they do not hear during a trial. This is a critical piece of trial work. Trial lawyers will, when it benefits them, remind jurors not to speculate about certain things that there has been no information on. But attorneys will also hint and walk the line of permissible inference. An attorney cannot say the detectives coerced a confession out of Lewis during the 4 hours of interrogation before the tape was turned on and started recording when they had sufficiently beaten it out of him. But Mueller can and did say to the jury that we don't know what happened during the 4 hours of interrogation before they turned the tape on. He hasn't directly asked the jury to speculate as to what police misconduct may have taken place during those 4 hours, but he has certainly made the implication that something nefarious happened. It's a good defense strategy to raise doubts about a prosecution's case. And ultimately, his insinuations of police impropriety and a racist DNA collection method took hold in some jurors because the case ended in a hung jury, causing a mistrial. A hung jury means that the jury became hopelessly deadlocked and could not come to a unanimous decision. Now, this happens less frequently than you probably think. After attorneys give their summations and the judge instructs the jury on the law they are supposed to apply, they're put in a deliberation room. There, they confer in secret to try and come to a unanimous determination of guilty or not guilty. It does happen that some people dig in on their opinions and say, I'm not changing my mind ever, and you can never convince me otherwise. In those situations, a note comes out from the jury to the judge to say, "We're deadlocked." At this point, the judge brings all the jurors back into the courtroom and tells the jury to take a deep breath, keep an open mind, be open to counterarguments. In the overwhelming majority of cases, that is enough to break a deadlock and a verdict is reached. That didn't happen here. At least one person absolutely refused to go along with the rest, and so the judge had to declare a mistrial. It's up to the judge's discretion how long he or she is willing to let a jury deliberate in a deadlocked state before declaring that the trial is a mistrial because the jury is hung. In this case, the jury deliberated for one day and declared themselves hopelessly split. That is a really short period of time for a judge to declare a mistrial, but that's what happened. When a mistrial is declared, it basically resets the trial process. In no way does it mean that the defendant is let go or that the case is over. It's neither a win nor a loss for the defendant, and it can actually help each side. For the prosecutor, it allows them to look at their case and see where they need to provide more clarity or reinforce points or strengthen arguments. It allows them to see what the jury struggled with and make corrections or changes to their approach. For the defense, it creates more opportunities for inconsistencies. The testimony from the first trial is fair game for any which come after, meaning if that a witness testifies to something different in a second trial, the defense attorney can attack their credibility by cross-examining them on their previous sworn statements in the first trial. Witnesses will often find it very difficult to testify the exact same way two times in a row. So it allows the defense attorney to see where the jurors felt the holes were in the prosecution's case and maybe do a better job of exploiting them. Lewis was retried in March 2019, around 4 months after his first trial ended. The prosecution was better prepared to address the issues raised by the defense in the second trial and had much stronger arguments for the propriety of the police interrogation and the DNA collection. Lewis was convicted of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and sexual abuse after just 5 hours of deliberation. In summation, Lewis's legal aid attorneys did an admirable job of defending him in the face of overwhelming evidence. Sometimes you have the facts on your side to make real legal arguments that reason and logic dictate that the jury should acquit. Sometimes the facts and science aren't with you. You have to make an emotional argument that your client is being railroaded. Both can be effective, and knowing when to make each argument is a big, big part of trial work. Leventhal, for his part, made all the right arguments at the first trial. His only error was seating that at least one person on the jury who refused to change his mind. You can bet that he was especially sensitive on the retrial to potential juror concerns about police misconduct or racial biases. Lewis is currently serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Well, that wraps up the State of New York versus Chanel Lewis. Thanks again for listening and diving into this case with me. This was a little more on the abstract side rather than the outrageous fact-driven scenarios like the Casey Anthony affair. And let me know how you feel about that. Do you like the more theoretical tangents into trial work, or do you prefer to stick to the actual facts about what happened and just critique trial strategy? Send me an email at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. or connect with me through my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I'm also now on Twitter at InsummationPod. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe so you'll get notified when new episodes are released and rate the show, which makes it easier for other people to find it. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back for more.